Hi, welcome to this week's edition of Your Health. I'm health editor April Fulton. This week we have stories about milk and honey. We'll look at why some people seek out raw milk despite the health risks, and we'll hear about a growing hobby that's filling urban backyards with large white boxes and a suspicious buzzing sound. Yep, it's beekeeping. Also, we have a story on how race impacts the search for bone marrow transplants. First, let's start with a piece I did this week on raw milk, or fresh milk, as advocates say. That's the milk that comes straight from the cow or the goat without getting pasteurized. Selling raw milk is illegal in many states, but some people say it's more nutritious, and they go to great lengths to get it. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a sweltering summer day in Bowie, Maryland, and the Reitzig kids are ready for their snack.
Good job, buddy.
That's stay-at-home mom Liz Reitzig. She helps her youngest son Duncan, who's almost 2, pour the milk into his bowl of freshly sliced peaches. But Duncan's milk is practically contraband because it's illegal to sell raw milk in Maryland. Raw milk isn't pasteurized, and it's hard to get. The stuff you buy at the store is usually pasteurized, which means it's superheated to kill harmful germs. But there are some people willing to take that risk with raw milk, and they're very vocal. Mom Liz Reitzig is one of them.
I just think it's so silly. I can go out and get a six-pack of beer anywhere and a carton of cigarettes.
She says the family started drinking raw milk about 6 years ago after her second child was born. Reitzig rolls her eyes thinking about how she has to drive 2 hours or more every week to Pennsylvania to buy it.
Legally, I can feed my children fast food 3 meals a day, but then to get this incredible nutrient-dense, fresh, local food, the farmer in my state is criminalized for selling that to me.
But there's a good reason for that, according to health officials.
Raw milk is associated with significant human illness and potentially with microbes that are deadly.
David Acheson used to head the Food Safety Division at the Food and Drug Administration. He says the Reitzigs are taking a big risk, especially if bacteria hiding in the cow's fecal matter gets in the raw milk. That bacteria would almost certainly be killed if the milk was pasteurized. Bacteria like the one made infamous for recently hiding in spinach and ground beef and cookie dough. E. coli 0157H7.
That's the one that I worry about because we know from clinical experience that can very readily land you in hospital with kidney failure and is potentially deadly.
But Mom Liz Reitzig says if you're gonna eat, you're gonna take some risks. Any food can spoil or become contaminated. Reitzig and others who buy raw milk say drinking it is part of their philosophy. Eating more local and natural foods is healthier. They say it clears up allergies and helps with milk intolerance. But Acheson doesn't buy it.
You know, a lot of that is anecdotal. I have never been convinced by any science that that's the case.
But he does admit that pasteurization kills some nutrients in milk.
You are going to impact vitamins. You are going to do other things to it. But in the grand scheme of things, of a complete healthy diet, it is frankly, in my opinion, irrelevant.
The food safety expert says not getting sick is what's important. He would never drink raw milk. But he thinks banning it only encourages Liz Reitzig and others to skirt the law, and that could put them at greater risk. If you're one of the 1 to 3% of the population that drinks raw milk, Acheson says, make sure that the cows are clean, your hands are clean, and the bottles are sterilized and stored properly. April Fulton, NPR News, Washington. The growing local food movement has led to a renewed interest in planting community vegetable gardens and keeping chickens in the backyard. But recently, more people are adding beehives, particularly women. NPR's Allison Aubrey looked into this phenomenon and examined some age-old health claims about honey.
Just outside Cleveland, in the town of Medina, Ohio, there's been a big shift in who's signing up for beekeeping classes. There were twice as many students this year compared to last. And who are these new beekeepers? Well, lots of them are women.
The surge has really been with younger urban women. And 20 years ago, nobody would have guessed that.
Kim Flottam has been teaching beekeeping for years, and he says this seems to be the trend. Nationwide, there are roughly 100,000 backyard beekeepers. Subscriptions to the publication Bee Culture are on the rise. And when he published a how-to book aimed at making beekeeping easier with more lightweight equipment, 60,000 people snapped up copies.
I know how I feel when I take my honey out of my beehives. I feel really excited. I mean, I tell everybody. I post it on my Facebook.
Jen Sass is one of these women at the top of the new beekeeping bell curve. As she walks me out to her two hives that sit along the fence of her small backyard just outside Washington, D.C., I ask her why she thinks people are so gaga for bees.
I think there's a real sort of revival of an interest in rural type things. I think also it's something...
Even if there are urban horns in the background.
Yeah, we're very urban here.
And also very into the local food movement. So even if space is at a premium, the beauty of bees is that they can pollinate flowers and plants and yards all over her neighborhood. As she lifts off the cover of one of her hives, she says she loves to watch the bees at work.
What I'm trying to discover is how productive my bees have been.
Looks like there's plenty of honey, so that's good. But there's also a bunch of bees loafing at the bottom of the hive. These are the male bees, the drones. Their sole purpose is to fertilize the queen, and now that they've done it, they're just hanging out. So the queen is about ready to kick them out. She gives this job to her female worker bees.
They kind of peck and bother them and kind of chase them out, unfortunately. It's a cold winter if you're a drone.
It's really cutthroat, the hive. If you're a slacker, you're out. And this has served the honeybee species well over the millennia. But Sass says there's a big problem for bees these days. Despite all the urban enthusiasm, turns out that honeybee populations are way down. There's a syndrome called colony collapse disorder, where whole hives suddenly perish.
We've lost 40% of our bee colonies in the last 10 years. So it's really a mystery what's happening.
Now, if the only thing bees did was to make honey, maybe this wouldn't be a big deal. But bees are hugely important to our food supply. Jen Sass, who also happens to be a scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, explains bees pollinate billions of dollars worth of fruits and vegetables every year. And I'm willing to bet any of you out there listening now that before this day is over, you'll have eaten something, maybe an apple, a cucumber, some blueberries or almonds, that could not have been grown without the bees. So how does this all work? Well, let me introduce you to commercial beekeeper Dave Hackenberg. He drives his beehives all over the country, from cranberry bogs in New England to almond groves in California, so they can pollinate these crops. We reached him in his truck en route to another delivery.
We're actually in Tamaqua, Pennsylvania. Just got done delivering bees to pumpkins.
Yep, he said pumpkins. Now, no one's thinking about jack-o'-lanterns or pumpkin pie in July, but this is prime growing season, and without bees in the field to pollinate, the pumpkins just wouldn't grow right. They'd be lopsided or really small, and the farmer wouldn't get enough pumpkins to make it worth his time. So you can see why farmers need bees. But Dave Hackenberg says it's getting tougher for commercial beekeepers like him to make a good living. He's lost a bunch of hives to this colony collapse phenomenon.
When you're losing thousands of them and you got to replace them on a yearly basis, then you're probably going to go out of business.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is trying to prevent this. They're handing out some $6 million in emergency assistance this summer to beekeepers who've lost their hives. And meanwhile, scientists are still trying to figure out what's causing bee colony collapse. The latest thinking is that some combination of viruses, mites, pesticides, and climate change may be weakening the immune system of bees. For now, there's plenty of honey to go around, thanks in part to the enthusiasm of urban pioneers like Jen Sass.
For sure there is a food revolution, and the revolution is to stay local and be more excited about, you know, what you can put on the table from, you know, within 50 feet of your house.
And if you've ever wondered whether the liquid gold really has healing powers, well, you can find out the answer in my web show, Tiny Desk Kitchen, on NPR.org. I'm Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
There are some interesting insights into honey. I guess my grandma was right. Honey can help heal cuts. Now we're going to shift gears a bit. Joining me today is our health blogger, Scott Hensley, to talk about this week's highlights on our blog Shots. Hi, Scott.
Hey, April.
How are you?
Great. How about you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. One thing that intrigued me on the blog this week was the investigation into genetic tests. Tell me, I've heard a lot about genetic testing recently. What exactly are we talking about here?
The issue is a very particular kind of test. These are tests sold by companies directly to consumers, regular people who can either buy them on the internet. Amazon sells one. You take a little swab inside your cheek, a saliva sample that includes some cells from the inside of your mouth, send that off to the company, and then they test it for a whole bunch of different genes and markers that have been linked in the scientific literature to different kinds of risks for disease, reactions to medicines, and also for the historically minded, where your ancestors came from. What's your genetic profile like, and what does that tell you about your forebears?
That sounds pretty cool. What's the problem with it?
The curiosity part about your ancestors, no problem there. But when the tests purport to tell you, well, maybe this drug you might have a bad reaction to this drug, or, oh, you are at particular risk for a particular form of cancer, then there's a legitimate question of whether the Food and Drug Administration should be asking for proof that that stuff is right.
So there was an investigation this week and a hearing on the Hill. Did they decide that the FDA should do more about these kind of tests, or...?
The momentum is in that direction. What's happened in recent months is that the agency has asked the companies for information about their products and services, how they're marketing them, what they're telling consumers, what, in fact, they've done to test the tests themselves to make sure that they're accurate. What came out at this hearing was the results of an investigation into how some of the claims are being made directly to consumers.
This was like a sting operation, right? Undercover federal agents.
Exactly. The Government Accountability Office had some people pose as consumers talking with a variety of the companies about how the tests worked and then what it would mean if certain results came back. And some of the things that they found out, for instance, were one woman who asked whether it was okay for her to surreptitiously test her fiancé and then surprise him with the test results. That's actually a no-no. You're supposed to enter into this with your eyes wide open, have an agreement that you understand the risks and the limitations of the tests, and he wouldn't have been in a position to do that. Mm-hmm. There were a woman...
Surprise, honey, I tested your DNA.
Yeah.
Not sure that that's a good wedding present necessarily.
Yeah, a lot of issues there, but we'll just talk about the FDA for now. One woman asked about breast cancer risk, and the person on the other end of the line from the company told her that, yes, in fact, if a result came back that way, that it pretty much meant that the woman was going to get cancer, and that's not at all the case. Mm. So the upshot of it all was that despite the notion put out by the companies that these are perfectly valid kinds of informational, non-medical tests for people to want to know about, that there are claims being made that the FDA could legitimately say, look, that puts it in our camp, and we need to find out more about that before we allow you to sell it.
Hmm. Interesting. Speaking of medical tests, another post that you did this week was about whether or not people should get knee surgery for torn ACLs. Now, I remember in high school, every female jock had a torn ACL, and they all had surgery. It seemed like the only thing to do, but now that's not necessarily the case.
There was a study that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine this week that was done in Sweden, and they got between 100 and 200 folks to agree to either be treated mainly with rehabilitation or to go rehab plus early surgery and then see what happened to them. And the bottom line was that after 2 years, the folks who went into the rehab-oriented group did just as well as the ones who were in the early reconstruction, surgical reconstruction group. Hmm. And, you know, obviously that would cost a lot less. There's a lot of wear and tear on your knee as you get that surgery and then have to do even extra special rehab to build it back up afterwards. What was interesting to me about this, besides the fact that I had made a personal choice 20 years ago not to have reconstructive surgery after tearing an ACL, is that so little was really known. You know, here was a procedure that everybody took for granted as, well, we should do this. It's possible to do. It makes sense in a way. Yes, you know, this very important ligament that holds your knee together, if it's missing, well, why wouldn't you want to put it back together, mm-hmm. even if you have mm-hmm. to do something rather heroic to make that happen? Well, what this shows us is, for major interventions like rebuilding someone's knee, it's probably a good idea to compare it with an alternative, doing nothing or doing something that's less expensive and maybe less involved, but has also good reasons to think that it would work. You know, you strengthen the knee by rehabbing it and build up these muscles to keep it in place. And for many people, that's enough. So mm-hmm. I think the lesson here is, when you're looking at something that's new, as cool as it may sound, you want to make sure that you compare it to something else to see whether the claims made for it are all they're cracked up to be.
So basically, like we so often conclude here, you and I, talk to your doctor.
Absolutely. And listen, this is a profoundly personal choice. I mean, it's not to say that reconstruction is not the right option for some people. And there were specifics about the kinds of injuries that would have been relevant for the rehab-only approach versus surgery. For instance, if you've torn more than one ligament, you're probably going to have to go more towards the reconstruction route. Also, if there's other mm-hmm. kinds of damage that you've done. So it depends on the particulars of your case. Talk with your doc. But don't be afraid to ask the question, well, do I really need that?
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing women should talk to their doctors about is having a vaginal birth after a cesarean section. The rate of cesareans in the United States is really high, and doctors are under a lot of pressure to try to reduce that because there's not as many risks as we once thought for trying to have a natural birth afterwards. Tell me what you found out about that this week.
There have been so many cesarean sections in recent decades, in recent years, that it's a challenge for a woman who wants to have another child. Well, should she have a cesarean again, or can she try a vaginal birth? There are worries that having a vaginal birth after cesarean has higher rates of complications, and there's some catastrophic ones.
Not to mention lawsuits.
Yeah, there are catastrophic ones that worry doctors. There could be some really serious things that can happen, but as people have looked at it more closely, the worst fears haven't been realized. And in fact, there's a cost to women and to society to have so many cesareans. Like the knee reconstructions, having a cesarean is a major procedure, and it costs a lot of money, and it's got recovery time associated with it for the women. So, you know, there's a reason if you think you could avoid a cesarean, you might want to. And what this group of obstetricians has said is, hey, we think that with a new guideline, we can say that having a vaginal birth after a cesarean is a safe and appropriate choice for more women than people had been thinking recently. And they've put this guideline out, and because they're such an influential group, it could help move the needle some.
Hmm. So once again, talk to your doctor.
Yes. This one, though, you may, you know, depending on whether your birth is happening all of a sudden or you're doing it according to a planned schedule, you may not have that much time to do it in the moment. So you probably want to talk early. Mm-hmm. If you're a woman who has had a cesarean before, talk it over very early, especially if you have in mind to try and avoid another cesarean.
I see. Interesting. Well, thanks a lot. There's some good stuff on shots this week. It's npr.org/shots. And finally, bone marrow transplants. They're often required for people with blood-related cancers. However, for a transplant to work, the patient needs to find a donor who has very similar genes. And most of the time, that means finding a match within the same race. NPR's Habiba Nosheen has this story about how difficult it is for African-Americans to find African-American donors.
Sean Austin sits in the living room of his home in Brooklyn, New York. She's beautiful in that picture.
He grabs a photo of his wife from on top of the piano. It shows an African-American woman with long straight hair, a slender build, and a mischievous smile. That was Sean's 42-year-old wife last year. In September, Jennifer Jones Austin was diagnosed with leukemia.
You know, my immediate thought was, okay, I'm going to lose my wife to cancer.
There was one way to save his wife's life, a bone marrow transplant. With no sibling match, they turned to the National Marrow Donor Program.
We thought it was no big deal. It's a database of 8 million plus people. Nope, somebody's got a match. Well, when you're of color, it's not that easy.
In 2008, 40% of Caucasians who didn't have a bone marrow match in their own families were able to receive a transplant through the National Marrow Donor Program. The rate for African Americans, 15%. One reason for the difference, fewer blacks sign up to be donors than whites. But there is one other barrier. African Americans tend to have a more rare genetic makeup than Caucasians because their genes tend to be more mixed racially, making finding a precise match that much tougher. When Jennifer Jones Austin couldn't find a match, her family appealed to the public in ads like this one shown in black churches and on the internet.
I and my family and my friends have been frantically searching for the last little while for a donor who can help me.
Experts say despite emotional pleas like this one, blacks are resistant to donating.
That's a very, very, very deep, deep issue in the black community. And it really stems from having a mistrust of what a lot of African Americans consider the system.
That's 38-year-old Akeem Deshay, who says given the way blacks have historically been treated by the health system, it's no wonder they aren't rushing to do cheek swabs to have part of their DNA registered with the National Marrow Donor Program.
I recall, I had the same feelings. I never, ever, ever gave blood.
But his own attitude changed in 2003 when he learned that he needed a bone marrow donor or he would die.
My thing was, first of all, I don't know these people. They're going to be sticking me with needles, I just can't trust someone to stick me with needles.
His sister's marrow saved his life. Now he spends his time recruiting other blacks to sign up. In addition to the mistrust, many fear that being a donor is painful. But thanks to advances in science, donating can be relatively pain-free. But without enough black donors, Sean Austin's wife, Jennifer, was running out of time. So doctors turned to a less desirable option.
Essentially, I received cord blood from a newborn baby.
So cells from an umbilical cord that matched Jennifer's genetic makeup were used to save her life, an option with longer recovery times and sometimes the fear that the cell supply might not be enough.
There have been days where I've stayed on this couch from 9 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock.
Jennifer sits on her beige sofa. Her face looks nothing like the photo on her piano. No longer do the long locks frame her face. Instead, a few strands of tiny hair peek out of her bald head.
While I may be cured of leukemia, it is a lifelong treatment process. I've got to find that place where I can be forward-thinking, but all the while be mindful that nothing's promised.
Jennifer wasn't able to find a bone marrow donor and had to settle for cord blood. But she says she's already heard that of the 12,000 or so donors who were mostly blacks that signed up trying to save her life, there ended up being matches for other African Americans who needed transplants. That, she says, makes her feel that there was a higher purpose to her illness. Habiba Nashin, NPR News, Washington.
And that's it for this week's edition of Your Health. For more health news, check out our website at npr.org/health. I'm April Fulton. Thanks for listening.